More on issue two, on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this week-ending edition of Principles and Policies. I am your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy, along with my friend and sidekick and Vice Chairman of my board, Chuck Michaels.
Even more light being generated today.
And hopefully, maybe we'll keep the heat down, but generate more light. If you've been with us all week, you know we've been talking about the state ballot issues that are going to be before you on November the 8th, and right now we're in the third segment of discussing state issue two. Now, State Issue 2 is a referendum on the law that was passed by the General Assembly called Senate Bill 5, which is a series of changes to Ohio's 28-year-old collective bargaining law for state and local government public sector employees who are unionized. As we've talked about, we want to try to get past some of the propaganda and get down to the actual functions that are in the bill and discuss whether or not they're good or bad. And we've been doing a little bit of that over the last couple of segments. But we're going to keep going on here because a couple of the other things that this bill does is that make some changes in the collective bargaining laws related to teachers. And we've talked a little bit about teachers and striking and things, but this also goes into the situation that right now we have in our public school systems that if there have to be layoffs, the layoffs are not done based upon whether or not an individual has had stellar reviews or ratings, have a boatload of extra CEUs, continuing education units, they've gone above and beyond, maybe they've actually written a thesis or they've won a national competition. If they've been there less time than the other teachers, they're the first ones on the chopping block. Seniority layoff is what that's called, where the less seniority that you have, the higher on the layoff totem pole you become when they have to start cutting back. What this does is it eliminates that and changes it to what's called a merit-based system. Now, merit-based basically says that you retain teachers based upon their performance. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know about you, whether if you're not in a public employee situation, if you're in the private sector, your continued employment is really based upon not how long you've been there. It's based upon performance now, isn't it?
You bet it is.
Because that's just really, if you have two employees, let's say I have two employees. I have employee X and I have employee Y. And employee X has been there for 10 years. Does an average job, maybe does a little bit below average, maybe has a, you know, has been tardy a few times, been sick quite a bit, and I have employee B who's only been there, you know, a couple years shorter than that person, but is exemplary, goes above and beyond the call of duty, basically does everything you ask him to do and does it in stellar fashion. And, of course, we all know people like that because we look at those in the mirror, people in the mirror every day, don't we?
If only.
But the point is, If I'm at the school board level or the state or the superintendent of the public school system, and I'm faced with those two employees, and those employees happen to be teachers, and I have to lay one of them off, I don't get the luxury, and I guess it is a luxury, of saying, let me judge you based upon your performance. And honestly, for the long-term benefit of the school district and the kids in the district, the teacher who's applying themselves, who's going above and beyond the call of duty, and who causes no problems, well, you haven't been here as long, so we've got to let you go.
There's a false philosophy at the base of that. And the false philosophy is the idea that all workers are equal. The only difference is the amount of time they've spent on the job. And we all know that's false. But it's a form of radical egalitarianism that grows out of the base of what the union movement is all about. Now, the union movement, they tout themselves as someone who came in and saved the day for mine workers and all kinds of things. And in some cases they did, because there was some abuse. But the fact is that the basis of unionism is the idea of what we've discussed a lot about, and that is the difference between republic and democracy. And that is the democratic ideals that we're all the same, everyone is equal, everyone has exactly the same ability. And again, we know from life that that's simply false.
That's true. Now, you know, before we also start getting the calls and letters from you about this, this isn't going to be, this whole idea of merit selection is not going to be based on whatever local and superintendent feels like or whatever cronyism has been developed already within the local system. This performance-based pay and retention for teachers is based in large part, and it's in this law, on evaluations conducted under a policy that's based on a framework for teacher evaluations that's been recommended by the Superintendent of Public Instruction, that's the State Superintendent of Schools, and adopted by the State Board of Education. Now, the State Superintendent is an appointed position, granted, but the State Board of Education is members who are in their in 11 districts are elected by you, the voters. So they're going to be putting together the framework and saying, this is the policy you have to follow when you evaluate your teachers. So you can't have a superintendent who wants to play favorites because maybe a family member happens to be a teacher in their district and they want to keep the family member over the other teacher who's doing just as good a job, but because there's a situation there where there's personal bias involved. This is trying to help eliminate that personal bias and actually get it down to true performance-based job reviews and retentions. Now, I think in that particular aspect of this bill, they've done a very good job of saying it's a problem for this just to be flat out that you get automatic pay raises based on how long you've been there. So in other words, if you can sit in there and sit in the classroom and do nothing for 20 years, you're going to get this level of salary. Mm-hmm. Plus, anybody who's been there less time than you are, they get fired before you do. And we've had situations, and we've heard about them, ladies and gentlemen, in the press, where you've had really bad teachers who, because of their entrenchment with their unions and because of their entrenchment and their longevity in a district, or maybe they transfer from one district to the other, they can't do anything with them. And other teachers who could be better than they are sacrificed because of the way the system has been structured. However, this system would say, no, we're going to put everybody on a merit base. We're going to get rid of these automatic step increases, which are basically unvoted, unbargained automatic pay raises just because you've made it through another 9 months of school as a teacher. Honestly, I'd like to have automatic pay raises just to assume that I'm going to get paid. Like for every 6 months that I'm on a job, I get an automatic bump in my pay. I'd be great.
Let's break this down to the bottom line, and that is that I don't get an automatic pay increase every year. I get a pay increase if my sales increase over the year. But the fact is that the teacher gets an automatic increase every year, and I get an automatic increase in my taxes due to the fact that the voters in my district just simply give the district everything they want as far as levies go.
Yes. Now, that's another interesting issue, but we're going to save that for another program.
Right, but it's part and parcel of this because
we talk about levies,
We're not discussing levies, but we're discussing the fact that public employees get automatic pay raises when, in fact, people in the private sector, especially the backbone of the private sector, which is privately owned businesses, generally don't.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And again, I think if we move that back to, maybe we change that to where there's more level with the way public sector employees are paid versus how private sector employees are paid. Now, this is not getting into, the average salary is like $97,000 for this person, and if they were in the private sector, they'd only be making $62,000. That's not what we're talking
about. That's outside the scope of this discussion.
No, what we're talking about is the fact that just because you've been there for 4 years doesn't mean you automatically get an 8% increase in your salary, or shouldn't. It doesn't. And oftentimes, the numbers are somewhat hyperbolic, but that's the situation that goes on. So the other thing that this would do is to, when it comes to benefits. Now, we've heard about benefits and things, and we were doing some numbers off air because one of the provisions about benefits, you hear about, like, they're paying for their health care. And they really want to make it so that the employer is only paying 85%, which means that the employee would pay 15% of their health care, vision, dental, whatever they have.
Right.
Because right now, I think they're saying that in many instances, they're only paying like a small percentage up to like 5%. Now, for those of us in the private sector, if we could just pay 5% of our healthcare costs and have our employer, if we're not working for ourselves, that is, pay the other 95%, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Big problem. And we mentioned this when we talked about this on Wednesday, is that it doesn't matter because whether it's 5%, 95%, or if it's 15%, 85%, the money that they're using to pay this is our tax dollars.
That's right. It all comes out of our pocket.
It all comes out of our pockets. Now, the one thing we did determine is if the personal share that has to be borne by the public employee, the unionized employee, is raised, then instead of selecting the Cadillac plans for healthcare, if there is a menu of healthcare options, they may not select the top level, which is going to cost the most. They may go down and, like many of us have to do, say, well, you know, my budget won't take me paying, you know, me getting a healthcare plan that is $25,000 a year,
right,
of which I'm only paying 5%. Now, if I have to pay another 10% on top of that, ooh, I have to make some decisions. Maybe I go down to the one that costs $20,000 a year, or 18,
right,
or 16 or 14 or whatever it has. Maybe I get rid of the dental or the vision portion of it and make it more affordable so that I'm still taking home the amount of money that I think I need to take home, but I'm still providing health care coverage. And we're going to talk about issue 3 over the weekend, which really gets into the whole idea of mandated health care coverage, but we'll save that for the weekend show.
Right.
Okay, so really when it gets right down to it, the big thing in relation to this benefit issue comes on the vacation and sick leave. Now, right now, this bill, as stands, if it's allowed to stay into law, would cap vacation leave for public employees at 7.7 hours accrued for every 2 weeks per biweekly pay period. 7.7 hours every 2 weeks. Now, I don't know how many of you are out there who do math. The reason why they're capping it at 7.7, which sounds pretty healthy, is because some of those members, many of them, are accruing 9.2 hours per biweekly pay period of vacation time. Now, we ran a little bit of numbering on that. That's 30 work days a year. So if you work for a year, you could take an entire month, 30 work days, 6 weeks off in vacation. I have never had a job where I got 6 full weeks of vacation after, and maybe this is one of these step things, but even after 5 years or 10 years in a job, I never had 6 weeks of vacation time.
I worked for a company that you could get to 5 weeks of vacation, and it took you had to be beyond your 20th anniversary.
Yeah, well, and again, and that's not necessarily what we're talking about here. And, of course, sick leave accrual. Now, everybody thinks, okay, yeah, people get sick, and so it's a nice benefit to have that you can take time off without burning your vacation or whatever or losing your pay. Right now, it would basically, most public employees get 4.6 hours per every two, roughly, give or take, and there's a little bit more than that, maybe 13 days a year. It would reduce it to 3.1 hours per pay period. So it would take it from 12 to maybe 10 days per year. That doesn't sound like a whole lot to lose if that means that the taxpayers are going to save some money on the amount of sick leave that's used or that is built up, accrued, and then cashed in when somebody retires. So those are some of the things we got to think about. But the question before us on Senate Bill 2, on State Issue 2, excuse me, Senate Bill 5, I said that wrong, is shall the law as passed be adopted? And it's a referendum. If you vote yes on State Issue 2, you're saying that Senate Bill 5 sounds reasonable enough that we should go ahead and enact these things into law, and the provisions that are problematic will get worked out in court. If you say no, that we should not enact this law and it should be repealed, then we're back to the drawing board again, and I'm sure there are probably going to be other attempts that are going to be made to try to get a handle on runaway spending and economic problems in our local communities by our state officials. So, ladies and gentlemen, you know, like I said, beyond the propaganda, look into the issue and then determine as you read it and you think about it carefully whether or not this deserves your support. And right now, we're both sitting here thinking we're not sure how we're going to vote on this because we see some of the good, we see some of the bad. But really, we want to leave it up to you to determine which way you need to go. But don't go with either way just by listening to 30-second sound bites. So we'll be back over the weekend to discuss, do a wrap-up and discuss State Issue 3. Be with us on Saturday at noon.
And now, here's a constitutional moment with the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
What can you do when the government uses the law to break the law? One of the constitutional functions of our government is to establish justice. Have you ever stopped to think of how a government actually goes about establishing justice? Well, in the American view of law, we establish justice by punishing injustice. Now, this concept has ancient and biblical roots. When government punishes the wicked for their unjust actions, it simultaneously rewards the righteous for their good behavior by protecting them from the wicked and allowing them to live in peace and quiet enjoyment of their God-given liberty. This is the proper role of civil government in our constitutional republic. But now we must ask ourselves, what's to be done when government uses the power of law to break the law? In the last 4 months, the federal government has violated the Constitution by attempts to own and control insurance companies, banks, automobile companies, and healthcare providers. None of this is legal, and of course, there is much more. Now, this is a huge problem. What can one person do? Well, can I suggest that for starters, we shouldn't be complicit in these unlawful schemes? If you take a paycheck from a government agency or for a program that is not authorized by the Constitution, this might be a good time to find other work. More righteous, more honest work. There's no use complaining about the lawbreaking if you are part of it yourself. This might be a hard thing to think about and a hard thing to do, but these are hard times. Should we be helping government agencies to break the law? Think about it. This is Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American View.